Welcome to the podcast on Lecture 10, Scottish Gothic. Today we'll be taking a look at James Hogg, Robert Louis Stevenson, and Margaret Oliphant. And I'll ask you to turn to the first slide, which tells you about today's session. Today's session is going to continue looking at the peers and heirs of Walter Scott. A few weeks ago, we took a look at Walter Scott's invention of the historical romance, and we looked at its success. Basically, it kick-started the novel in the 19th century. And created a space for people, particularly Scottish writers, to kind of pour into the domain of the novel. One direction that the novel took was, as we saw last week, John Galt's theoretical histories. You could say that we see John Galt stressing the historical in Walter Scott's conception of the historical romance. And in novels like The Annals of the Parish, Galt takes a look at historical processes at work in a provincial town with a particular group of people, and many of his novels do this. But today we're going to take a look at a different direction that fiction took in the 19th century, and in a way it's a direction that began before Scott and accelerated after him, mainly fueled by the success of Scott's own fiction. The success of Scottish Gothic lasts through the century, from early practitioners like Walter Scott's contemporary and friend James Hogg, through to later admirers and followers like Margaret Oliphant, who isn't born until 1828, she dies towards the end of the century. Robert Louis Stevenson is born halfway through the 19th century and dies at the very end. What these three authors have in common is that they all deal with the supernatural, in some of their work at least. And what we're going to argue today is that by addressing the supernatural, by moving away from history and looking at fantasy, Scottish authors were allowed to look at aspects of Scottish nature and culture that had been repressed. The next slide gives you a photograph of Edinburgh in the 19th century, and it gives you a sense of what this publishing centre might have looked like, must have looked like. It's smoky, it's dirty, it's crowded, it's bustling, it's exciting. And with London, it is the main source of publications in Britain. If we take a look at the next slide, we can see some of the major features of Scottish print culture, certainly in the earlier part of the 19th century. Scotland, and in particular Edinburgh, was home of huge reference work projects. The Encyclopaedia Britannica is one of the outcomes of the interest in Scottish Enlightenment science and Scottish Enlightenment knowledge training. The first edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica was published in Edinburgh in the final part of the 18th century, 1768 to 71. It took 3 years to publish the first edition. By 1810, it had grown to 40 volumes, the fourth edition, and its contributors included eminent Scottish authors like Walter Scott. Walter Scott contributed an entry to the 1810 edition on chivalry. Alongside major factual publishing ventures, there were magazines, or quarterlies, journals, like the Edinburgh Review that was founded in 1802, and Blackwood's Edinburgh Magazine in 1817, followed later in the century, 1832, by Chambers's Edinburgh Journal. Now these come out once a month. They were the main publishing outlets of the 1800s. Many novels were published first in the journals and then later republished in book form. And they account, the fact that you're reading novels in monthly segments accounts for the serial format, the kind of episodic nature of many novels of this time. It also accounts for the popularity of the three-volume novel. It fitted the format of journal publishing. Now these journals had political differences, some were Tory, some were Whig. They operated out of a fairly small town. Edinburgh was a small city, and so the people were very familiar with each other. And so there was a kind of intimacy about magazine publishing, and there was an informality about magazine publishing. And that contributed to a very strong, very cohesive print culture. The next slide shows the kind of people who were published by one of the most successful Edinburgh magazines, Blackwood's magazine, sometimes simply called MAGA. MAGA for magazine, people called it MAGA. And it published work by John Gibson Lockhart, Walter Scott's son-in-law, who was the editor. It published work by James Hogg, by John Wilson, John Galt, and later in the century, George Eliot was published in MAGA. Margaret Oliphant was an author and a critic who worked very much for MAGA. Anthony Trollope, Joseph Conrad, and Arthur Conan Doyle, before he published the Sherlock Holmes stories, published in Blackwood's magazine. The magazines, the journals, were cheap enough and popular enough to open a new kind of market for fiction. It was a mass market. And it's worth asking at this point what a mass market in fiction is for. And that's the subject of the next slide. What is mass market fiction for? It can fulfill romantic aspirations. People read it to escape. Mass market fiction can also offer readers an explanation of history or society. We can see that John Galt does this. Mass market fiction can attempt to explore mental or spiritual states, especially extreme ones. And one function of mass market fiction, perhaps, is just simply to scare the living daylights out of you. Remember, people were reading these journals by candlelight in long winter nights, sometimes alone, sometimes with friends, and perhaps they simply wanted to be frightened. This brings us to our next slide, and I want to go back and look at a quotation that we've already seen in this course by one of the major Enlightenment philosophers, Dougal Stewart, who's in that picture of Scott meeting Burns. And again, in his collected works, we find a kind of complacency. The idea that society has reached its most perfect state. To repeat the quotation, he says, "When in such a period of society as that in which we live, we compare our intellectual acquirements, our opinions, our manners and institutions with those that prevail amongst rude tribes, it cannot fail to occur to us as an interesting question by what gradual steps the transition has been made from the first simple efforts of uncultivated nature to a state of things so wonderfully artificial and complicated." And it's that final phrase that I want to focus on. People saw themselves living in Edinburgh as living in a state of things wonderfully artificial, wonderfully complicated. It was believed that this was the height of civilization. This was the Enlightenment, the Age of Enlightenment. This was the age in which progress had been achieved. So science was replacing superstition. Progress was replacing barbarity. But into this environment, if we take a look at the next slide, come dreams, come fantasies, come nightmares, as we can see in Henry Fuseli's painting, painted in 1781, at the very height of the Enlightenment. He has this nightmare vision of a kind of grotesque barbarian animal, an ape man, sitting in the chest of a swooning woman. So although we've become very rational, very scientific, we are at the height of civilization, the repressed can still return to haunt us. And the next slide shows us that this is what we see in Gothic fiction. Gothic fiction is what, in some respects, Walter Scott's fiction superseded. It predates Walter Scott. And in Gothic fiction, by people like Horace Walpole's Castle of Otranto, Anne Radcliffe's Mysteries of Udolpho, and Matthew Lewis's The Monk, you can see a kind of extreme, sensational, fantasy type of fiction that was very, very popular. And it usually took place in Europe. It usually took place in Catholic Europe, and it usually involved innocent young women being threatened by sadistic, cruel, sinister authority figures like monks or aristocrats. And there was a kind of sensational pleasure to be had from these. They were incredibly popular, but not very respectable. And one of the things that I said earlier was that it's one of the reasons why Walter Scott published anonymously. It wasn't really respectable for a male to be publishing novels. Poetry before Scott published was much more respectable than fiction. So Gothic fiction predated Walter Scott, and in fact, Walter Scott talks about it in the introduction to Waverley, when he's talking in his first novel about the title that he's chosen to 60 years hence. And that's the next slide. He says, had I, for example, announced in my frontispiece, Waverley, a tale of other days, must not every novel reader have anticipated a castle, scarce less than that of Udolpho, of which the eastern wing had long been uninhabited, and the keys either lost or consigned to the care of some aged butler or housekeeper, whose trembling steps, about the middle of the second volume, were doomed to guide the hero or heroine to ruinous precincts. So he's commenting on Gothic fiction, and he's parodying Gothic fiction, and he's creating distance between his own work and Gothic fiction. And it's very interesting to read the introduction to Waverley to see what Scott says about Gothic fiction. He says that kind of respectable gentlemen say that they don't read this stuff, but secretly they keep it in a drawer by their bedside table. I guess it's a little bit like the Twilight series or 50 Shades of Grey, incredibly popular, but nobody really wants to admit to having read it. So how do we read popular fiction? And that's the topic of the next slide. One way to read it is through topics like gender and sex, postmodernism, psychoanalysis, Marxism. And if you're interested in looking at the systematic ways of looking at popular as well as literary fiction, there is an interesting website at Purdue University in the United States, which will guide you through some of these theoretical approaches to popular fiction. The one that we're going to focus on today is the final one on the list. It's psychoanalysis. One way of interpreting ghosts, fantasies, demons is the projection of a disturbed mind. And obviously that invites a psychoanalytical approach to analysis. The next slide is taken from the Purdue course, and it's a quotation from Freud, a citation of Freud. It says, as Freud puts it in Introductory Lectures on Psychoanalysis, the first lecture, we believe that civilization is to a large extent being constantly created anew, since each individual who makes a fresh entry into human society repeats this sacrifice of instinctual satisfaction for the benefit of the whole community. What happens instead, as he goes on to explain, is that those primitive impulses, of which sexual impulse is the strongest, are sublimated or diverted towards other goals that are socially higher and no longer sexual. Now, this is an interesting quotation for a number of reasons. The first is that it talks about civilization. And you'll remember the Dugald Stewart quote of a couple of slides ago, where he says, we have reached the highest point of civilization. Things are wonderfully artificial. Things are wonderfully complicated. What Freud is saying here is that, yeah, there's a price to pay. If things are wonderfully artificial and things are wonderfully complicated, it's because we've sacrificed our instincts. We've sacrificed certain satisfactions that we might naturally desire. And these primitive impulses are diverted into socially higher goals of civilization. However, when we sleep, when we dream, when we fantasize, these instinctual impulses come back to haunt us. And this is the return of the repressed. The next slide goes on to say, our instincts and primitive impulses are thus repressed. However, Freud believed that the sexual impulse was so powerful that it continually threatened to return and thus disrupt our conscious functioning. hence the now famous term, the return of the repressed. And if you want to read more about that, I recommend that you take a look at the modules on Freud in the Purdue Guide to Critical Theory. But the next slide sums up the framework of psychoanalysis that we're going to use in this lecture. We're going to assume that fiction shares with the psychological unconscious a symbolic organization. Our minds are organized symbolically. Fiction is organized symbolically. So there is an analogy, a reason for looking at fiction as if it is the unconscious mind. We're going to assume that civilization demands the repression of the individual's unconscious instinctive desires. We don't know what we're repressing. We're not conscious of it. That's why it's the unconscious. But when we sleep, when we dream, when we fantasize, it comes back. Maturity, growing up, involves a separation from animal instincts and a recognition of the other. We begin to accept that other people, other entities exist, but that demands the repression of the ego. In everyday life, these instinctive desires, the repressed, returns in the form of dreams and slips of the tongue, fantasies. And in fiction, these desires return in the form of fantasy, the grotesque, ghosts and demons. And the ghosts and demons and grotesque and fantasies are symbolically organized. So when we take a look at the patterns of symbolic organization in fiction, we can begin to ask the question, what exactly is being repressed? The next slide suggests a methodology, a way of answering this question. When we're asking what is being repressed in Gothic fiction, we can first ask, well, what is the nature of the supernatural being? What kind of being is it? Why does it take the form that it takes? Is it, like Fuseli's nightmare, is it a primitive ape man that is coming back? Is that the symbol of the unconscious desires? What's the relationship of the supernatural being to the protagonist? Again, if you're thinking of Fuseli's painting of the swooning woman, what's the relationship of the ape man who's sitting on her chest and herself? There are various possible answers to that. But it's worth asking, what is the nature of the relationship? Finally, how does the manifestation of the supernatural being relate to standard psychological themes? We can think of what Freud was fascinated with. Obviously, everything for Freud is sexuality. So you could begin by asking, well, does it have to do with sexuality? But there are other themes as well as sexuality. You can say, well, what kind of things are being othered? What is being pushed away into the status of something that is not me? I am civilized, therefore the other is primitive. I am human, therefore the other is animal. I am clean, therefore the other is guilty. I am white, therefore the other is non-white. What is being pushed away? And what is being presented as reality? And what is being presented as a dream? Are the ghosts real? The first of three texts that we're going to take a look at and try to answer these questions about is James Hogg's novel, The Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner. Hogg is one of the writers who's closest to Walter Scott. They were friends, they were rivals. Hogg was pretty much the same age as Walter Scott. He was born in 1770, died in 1835. In some respect, excuse me. Take a drink. Sorry about that. In some respects, Hogg's earlier life resembles Burns. He was an illiterate farm labourer. Later he was called the Ettrick Shepherd, or simply the Shepherd. And he was illiterate until later in life. And he started writing poetry, he collected ballads, and he later moved, like Scott did, to writing novels, he pretty much followed the trajectory of Scott. He collected ballads, wrote poetry, and then graduated to writing novels. He was a friend of Walter Scott, became part of a Scott's literary circle in Edinburgh, a circle that included John Galt. As I said, Edinburgh was a small town. These people knew each other, read each other. And in 1824, 10 years after Waverley, and I think about 3 years after the Annals of the Parish, he writes this very, very strange novel called The Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner. The next slide summarises the novel. It's a narrative that begins a whole series of novels, plays, poems in Scotland that celebrate doubleness. It then becomes a theme, a kind of running theme in much of Scottish literature. The idea that we have double identities. And doubleness runs through this novel by James Hogg. First of all, it's weird. The story is told twice. The narrative is first told by an editor in the third person, and then in the sinner, the justified sinner himself, tells his own story. His name is Robert Ringham. So first the editor tells his story, and that's about half the book, and then the sinner himself tells the same story again, but from a different point of view, his first person point of view. Like Scott's fiction, it's set in the past. It's set in the late 17th century. And it's about Robin and George. They marry and have two sons, George Jr. and Robert. But it's suggested by the novel, implicitly, not directly, that Robert is not actually Robin's... that Robert is not actually George's son. That Robert is the son of Robina's spiritual advisor, the Reverend Ringham, Robert Ringham. And Robert takes Ringham's name, and he's inducted into the Calvinist belief in the elect. Now, we saw this belief earlier in the course in Holy Willie's Prayer. It's the idea that there are some people that are justified by faith and not good works. And what God will do is he will reveal to you that you're one of the elect, and nothing that you will do, good or bad, will change that. So Robert, like Holy Willie, is a member of the elect, or believes himself to be a member of the elect. And one of the things that he starts doing, as we see in the next slide, is that he begins to stalk his brother. Two brothers, possibly different fathers, Robert starts stalking George. And at one point, he nearly throws George from a cliff. The cliff is Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh. Later in the novel, George is stabbed to death in a tavern, and a prostitute identifies Robert as the attacker. He's been aided by a mysterious man who is the double of George's friend. And Robert disappears before his arrest. So we can see here two brothers, doubles, doppelgangers. And that's the first half of the novel. Then in the second half of the novel, as we see in the next slide, the sinner Robert confesses. In the second part of the novel, the same story, the story of brotherly rivalry, stabbing, death. The same story is told from Robert's own point of view. And for the first time in the story, we see Robert's meeting with a mysterious stranger, a man called Gil Martin. And this happens fairly soon after Robert's possible father, the mother's spiritual confessor, Reverend Ringham, inducts Robert into the elect. Robert believes he's a member of the elect, and then he meets this mysterious stranger. And the mysterious stranger tempts George into tempts Robert into murdering George, which Robert does. But then Robert begins to doubt Gil Martin, who appears to take his own form to commit other crimes. Gil Martin seems to change shapes. Gil Martin can appear like different people. And at times, Gil Martin appears to be Robert and commits crimes with Robert's appearance, with his identity. And towards the end of the first-person narrative, Robert goes increasingly mad, and in despair, ultimately, we see him preparing to commit suicide. His memoir is found in his grave. He begins to believe that Gilmartin is a devil, and he is not a member of the elect. He's been inducted into the damned. It's a scary novel. As we see in the next slide, like many Gothic novels, it pretends to be fact. A number of the earlier Gothic novels at the end of the 18th century pretended to be authentic travelogues or pretended to be found manuscripts. Hogg's fiction was also presented as an authentic document. It was published anonymously, but it includes a reference to Hogg himself as a real person. And its original publication was advertised by a letter in Blackwood's magazine. The letter was written by Hogg, and it advertised the actual discovery of Ringham's memoir in the grave. So the fictional episode is being presented in a letter in the journal as fact. So you've got an obviously fantastic story, but it's being presented as if it's fact. And one of the questions that you can ask within the context of the novel is, who is Gilmartin? He is obviously the supernatural element. So why does he take the form that he takes? What's his relationship with the protagonist? And is he real, or is he a fantasy within the novel? Is he a figment of Robert's imagination? Well, as with many Gothic novels, it's like this with A Library Window. There are indications that he's real. Other people sometimes see him. But there are also some indications that he's just there in Ringham's imagination. So the reader is always being wrong-stepped. Part of the suspense of the novel is in not knowing. Next slide. The doubleness that you find in the novel creates tensions. The editor's narrative, the first part of the book, and the sinner's narratives do not match in some details. So sometimes you think, well, the editor's unreliable, and sometimes you think, well, Ringham's obviously crazy, he's unreliable. But you're never entirely sure that you've got one reliable narrator. And certainly Robert, as he descends into madness, cannot be seen as a reliable narrator. So it's a novel that teaches you not to trust it. In the next slide, asking who or what Gilmartin is, what form it takes, I've got three quotations from the novel when Gilmartin is asked this question. Robert asks him his name, and he tells him, and he says, well, what's your surname, sir? What's your surname? And Gilmartin says, oh, you must have a surname too, must you? Very well, you may call me Gilmartin. It is not my Christian name, but is a name which may serve your turn. So here we have a hint that Gilmartin is not a Christian. So what is he? Later in the novel he says, I have no parent save one, whom I do not acknowledge. Therefore pray drop that subject. He's asked about his parents. He says he has no parents except one whom he does not acknowledge. Now is this, again, Lucifer? Lucifer has no parents except one whom he does not acknowledge, and therefore he does not want to talk about it. The name Gilmartin is an interesting name. In Gaelic it means the servant of Martin. Sir Martin's running footman was, in Scots folklore, a euphemism for the devil. And it turns up, for example, in Thomas Urquhart's Rabelais in chapter 23. So the name Gilmartin might be chosen as a euphemism for the devil. It's like Old Nick, a name that Scottish folklore gives to the devil. So there are clues there that Gilmartin is the devil, is Lucifer. So you have a kind of religious reading as one possibility. What about the psychoanalytic reading then? Well, in the next page we've got a quotation from a critic called Brewster, who says, as Ian Duncan, a Scottish critic working in California, as Ian Duncan points out, Hogg understood himself emerging from pre-modern, largely pre-literate rural folk culture, its authentic primitivism distinct from a politically aware rural working class of southwest Scotland associated with Burns. Hogg's concern with the delirium, paranoia, and obsession expresses his critical engagement with post-Enlightenment modernity and with rural traditions, his sense of being inside and outside both of these temporalities. So if you like, and it's useful to think back to Dougal Stewart's quotation once again, Hogg thinks of himself as being part of both of Dougal Stewart's communities. Part of him comes from the primitive tribes. That was his part of Borders Scotland. He comes from an uncivilized part of Scotland. But he also belongs partly to Edinburgh. He moves in Enlightenment circles. He's a friend of Walter Scott. So he's inside civilized Edinburgh, and he's outside civilized Edinburgh in a primitive farming community. So in a psychoanalytic reading of the Private Memoirs and the Confessions of a Justified Sinner, Gilmartin is the rural superstition, the primitive countryside of Scotland, coming back to haunt Enlightenment Scotland. So in the next slide, we can see Gilmartin as a symbol of the return of demonic forces that have been banished by rational, Enlightenment, scientific Scotland. And if we take a look at Robert himself, the sinner, he is split. He's got a split personality. He's got a fractured pre-union psyche. He symbolises religious fanaticism, religious extremism in a secular age. And he also represents madness in the age of reason. So the Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner becomes a key text in reading the Scottish Gothic. It introduces the idea of the double, and it introduces the idea that what is repressed may be an earlier kind of Scotland, a superstitious Scotland, a fanatical Scotland, a pre-civilised Scotland, maybe coming back to haunt Enlightenment Scotland. This theme comes up in a number of other stories. We can see it in a short story, a wonderful short story by Robert Louis Stevenson called Thrawn Janet, published much later in the century in 1881. It's a very interesting story to read. You have a narrative in English, a frame narrative in English that introduces the story. Then the story itself is told in first person. And in a way, that's like the Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner. You've got the editor's narrative framing the sinner's narrative. Here you've got the English frame story framing an oral narrative in Scots. You can see this also as a clash of literate culture. The frame story is in English, it's written English. But then you've got oral culture as the repressed. It's bursting through into the narrative itself. And again, the story revolves around religion. It's a Presbyterian minister, Mr. Soulis, or Souls, who apparently witnesses the reanimation of a woman, a kind of zombie Scottish woman, a woman called Janet, through diabolic possession, apparently. One of the things that you find that happens when this short story is translated into other languages, as Beatrix Hesse found out in an article on German translations of Thrawn Janet, that very often the translations simply drop the frame story. They simply tell the oral story. But it's very important to look at the balance between the frame story and the embedded narrative in Scots. The frame story, as I've said, is in English. It kind of puts the story in context. The narrative itself is in Scots. The frame represents literacy, the narrative, orality. The frame takes place in the mid-18th century. Again, it takes place in Enlightenment Scotland. But the embedded narrative takes place further in the past, in late 17th century, early 18th century Scotland, when folklore and superstition are still thriving, as opposed to mid-18th century Enlightenment Scotland. So it's very important for the story to work to have these oppositions in tension. If you lose the frame story, as many translations do, then you lose this tension between orality, literacy, rationality, and superstition. When the story is told, the oral narrator rejects the kind of Enlightenment learning that is symbolised, in fact, by this time by the Presbyterian minister. The Presbyterian minister arrives, a little bit like the minister in the annals of the parish. He's young, he's well read, he's not immediately trusted. And this quotation shows that. It says, and there were folk even then that said the Lord had left the college professors to their own devices, and the lads that went to study with them would have done mair and better sit in a peat bog like their forebears of the persecution, with a Bible under their oxter and a spirit of prayer in their hearts. There was nae doubt onyway that Mr. Soules had been hour lang at the college. So this is a narrator saying that Mr. Soules has the vice of education. He spent too long at the cottage, he spent too long with college professors, he would have been better sitting in a peat bog with a Bible in his armpit. The next slide is a quotation from Beatrix Hess, making the point that I was making earlier. Excuse me, about the English frame story. Beatrix says that the English frame to the Scottish narrated story represents an important distancing device vis-à-vis the supernatural events described in the embedded narrative. Taking his cue from an idea in Freud's Das Unheimliche, the uncanny, Svetan Todorov persuasively argued that the pure fantastic requires that the reader be kept in a permanent suspension between a supernatural explanation of the events depicted, the narrator's reliable, the ghosts are real, and a rational one, there are no ghosts, the narrator is mad. To put it differently, a story of the pure fantastic requires unreliable narration. In Thrawn Janet, the use of dialect in the embedded narrative persistently reminds the reader of the narrator's subjectivity and hence of his doubtful reliability. This is a beautiful quotation because it sums up one of the main features that you see in every Gothic narrative. You're always wondering, is the narrator reliable? Are the ghosts real? Or is the narrator unreliable, and am I spending my time with a mad person? So Thrawn Janet is the story of a kind of reanimated woman, and you've got to ask yourself again, why does she take that form? She's a woman to the Presbyterian man, she's old to his youth, she's the kind of country superstition to his educated Enlightenment sensibility. Maybe there's a kind of sexual fear there of femaleness. But there's many psychological ways of reading the tension between Mr. Soulis and Janet in Thrawn Janet. The final short story is the one that I asked you to read and to write psychological case notes on, and that's Margaret Oliphant's Library Window. And it's nice to talk about Margaret Oliphant because she's one of the first female writers that we've looked at in this course. Women become increasingly important from the 19th century on. Margaret Oliphant was born 1828, died at the end of the century, 1897. First novel was published in 1849, so about halfway through the century. 2 years later, she met William Blackwood, and she began a long association with him. He was the editor and owner of MAGA, and she contributed lots of stuff to MAGA. She was a critic for MAGA. Next week, we'll see some of her criticism of late 19th century novels. She had a difficult life. 10 years after her first novel was published, her husband died of TB, tuberculosis consumption. Her writing career was now important in supporting her and her three children. One of her children died, her brother was financially ruined, she started supporting his family too. Basically, she was a heroine. She's supporting all these people through her writing. And all of her children died before she did, all three of them. And she continued writing until her death at the age of 69. So she was one of the first really professional female writers in the 19th century. The Library Window is one of her last stories, 1896. It's published the year before she dies. And as you'll have read, you've got the story which sees a young girl at a window, and she sees the image of a young man framed by the library window opposite. Now, what is he doing? he's reading. And she's listening to the conversation of the people around her, and she discovers that the window is not a real window, it's been bricked up, and she's seen a ghost of a young man reading in a bricked-up library window. So we can ask the same kind of questions that we asked of Gilmartin and we asked of Thrawn Janet. Who are these apparitions? Why do they take the form that they do? Well, the story of the ghost in the library window is a young man who was attracted to the girl's ancestor and who waved to her from the library across the street. The man was murdered by the ancestor's brothers. The next slide tells you, or suggests, a way that we can read this ghost. And many of you suggested things like this in your case notes. Yes, you've got a young woman in puberty yearning for sexual companionship. The young man can symbolise an impossible object of desire. She wants to reach out across the space from her window to his window. But you've got to ask yourself, why a young man writing and reading in a library? Why is that attractive to the young girl? And this could be a yearning for things beyond sexuality, a yearning for scholarly freedom, what Virginia Woolf called a room of one's own, time, space, resources for study and writing. And in an article called Textual Seductions, which I've put in Moodle, Heller points to the description that is given of the girl watching the young man write. When she's watching him, his fingers move across the page, she becomes almost sexually excited by watching the act of writing. And Heller says that textuality and sexuality are very closely combined in this short story, and you have to ask again why. This is the next slide is the quotation from the story. The young girl is looking across, looking at the young man right, and she says, "It was like fascination. I could not take my eyes from him, and that little scarcely perceptible movement he made turning his head. I trembled with impatience to see him turn the page, or perhaps throw down his finished sheet on the floor, as someone looking into a window like me once saw Sir Walter do, sheet after sheet. I should have cried out if this unknown had done that. I should not have been able to help myself, whoever had been present, and gradually I got into such a state of suspense, waiting for it to be done, that my head grew hot and my hands cold." I don't know if you've ever watched anyone texting, but I don't think that kind of feeling comes over you when you do. So the next slide suggests a reason why the act of writing, the act of studying, might be so sexually attractive for the girl, or so instinctually attractive for the girl, that it's almost confused with the impulse of sexuality. And again, Heller quotes Margaret Oliphant, but this time her autobiography. When Margaret Oliphant is talking about her own life, and she talks about up to this date, 1888, this is when she's about 50. Up to this date, 1888, I have never been shut up in a separate room or hedged off with any observances. My study, all the study I've ever attained to, is a little second drawing room where all the feminine life of the house goes on. I don't think I've ever had 2 hours undisturbed except at night when everybody's in bed in my whole literary life. This is someone who wrote nearly everything, and she wrote a lot. She wrote nearly everything in a crowd, with no peace and no solitude. And perhaps she's projecting onto the young girl those desires for facilities, time, space, solitude that she, as a writer, never ever had, that she, as a woman, never ever had. We can take a look at recurring themes in the library window. We can ask again, is this a dream? Is it reality? Is the girl a reliable narrator and the man exists? Or is the girl an unreliable narrator and she's mad? Again, like James Hogg's Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner, you can see a tension between the reality of the ghost and the unreality of the ghost. At one point, the ghost slams the imaginary window and people look up. So people hear him. He's visible or audible for a second to other people. So you think, is he real? Or is it some kind of mass illusion? Is the library window a figment of an unreliable narrator's hormone-driven imagination? Or when the ghost opens a window at one point, people in the streets seem to hear it. An argument against this particular reading of the story is that elsewhere, Oliphant wrote critically of the rise of the new woman. She wrote critically of the professionally independent woman and who was sexually more liberated than her predecessors. So maybe Oliphant wasn't entirely in control of the themes that she was writing about in this. Perhaps Oliphant's yearning for identification with the impossible male domain of scholarship and art may be her own return of the repressed. It's not just the girl in the story, it's also Margaret Oliphant's return of the repressed, perhaps. So, to sum up, and if you've made it this far with me, well done. If we're thinking of the topic of today's lecture, again fitting in with the themes of hegemony, one of the arguments that you might want to make about Gothic fiction in the 19th century is it's the return of the non-hegemonic repressed, the return of the margins, the return of the uncivilized barbarian, in Dougald Stewart's words. It doesn't go away when you reach a wonderfully artificial, wonderfully sophisticated civilization. The barbarian is still there inside us. And the 19th century Gothic fiction, the Gothic novel and the Gothic short story, sees older Scotland, Scots-speaking, superstitious, irrational, often feminine, often emasculated. It sees those aspects of Scotland coming back through ghosts, through demons, through fantasies. But as the library window suggests, repressed anxieties can look forwards as well as backwards, towards a fear of modernity, the yearning for impossible desires. One of the things that the library window does, if we accept the reading that it's a desire for the male domain of scholarship, is it problematizes the status of woman. It says this woman is as she is because she is mad, because society creates her mad. It constrains her gender possibilities. If she had access to the male world of scholarship, she wouldn't see ghosts. So all these three texts today have looked at the return of the repressed. But if there is one novel, if there is one text that symbolises Scottish Gothic more than any other, it's Robert Louis Stevenson's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It's a canonical novel. It's been filmed God knows how many times. It's been translated into Portuguese several times. But we're going to take and it's also set in London, although it's really set in Edinburgh. And what we're going to argue next week is that it is perhaps the epitome of the return of repressed Highland Scotland. Thank you.